Hello and welcome to A History of the United States, episode 35, straight out of Connecticut. First of all, don't worry, this isn't the long-awaited musical episode, although hopefully we will have that one day. In fact, we're not even going to talk about Connecticut for the moment, because we still have some unfinished business with Rhode Island. We start today with one of the early great American women, Anne Hutchinson. Born in 1591 in Alford, England, Anne Marbury was the daughter of a clergyman, and so spent her early years in an intellectual atmosphere. In 1612, she married a merchant, William Hutchinson, and she remained interested in religious affairs. She was a follower of Reverend John Cotton, and travelled to Massachusetts in 1634. She was fascinated by Cotton's services, and started holding meetings at her house every Tuesday to discuss the sermons with her friends, the other women of the colony. Cotton highly approved of this. Hutchinson then did something rather unique for the time. She started talking about her own opinions. She didn't just have to talk about what Cotton thought, she had views too. Her meetings quickly gathered an audience as ministers and magistrates came to hear her speak. Her views centred on the individual relationship a person had with God, and that this relationship was far more important than the institutionalised beliefs and the opinions of the ministers. This was risky stuff, particularly in Massachusetts. As we've seen with Roger Williams, if there is one thing Massachusetts was about, it was about unity in the church. Hutchinson's opinion that the views of the church weren't that important when compared to an individual's views couldn't be tolerated. She was a social threat. She quickly found herself opposed, and her enemies accused her of antinomianism, which is the view that God's grace releases Christians from the need to observe strict moral principles. She found the concept of morality that her opponents were using very narrow, and she was supported at first, but this changed. The person behind the need for social harmony was John Winthrop, and he was respected above all. Once he opposed her, it was only a matter of time before her support fell away. She was tried by the General Court in 1637, and was sentenced to banishment, although she was held in custody until 1638, when she was tried before the Boston Church, and then excommunicated. What was she to do? Well, she decided to follow in the lead of Williams and go found her own settlement. She went to Aquidneck Island in Narragansett Bay and founded the settlement of Portsmouth with her supporters, including William Coddington. As I mentioned last week, it is certainly nice to have a strong, independent woman in the narrative. We haven't had many so far. Unfortunately, her story doesn't have a happy ending. Her husband died in 1642 and she decided to leave Portsmouth. She travelled west to the site of the Bronx in New York City, and then she and almost all of her children and servants were killed in an Indian attack in 1643. Rather than the grisly end, we should instead focus on the fact that she spoke her mind and went on to found one of the initial four townships of Rhode Island, which is pretty cool. Speaking of which, we've set up Providence and Portsmouth, but we still need to found Warwick and Newport, which is why we now turn to William Coddington. Coddington was born in England in 1601 and migrated to Massachusetts in 1630. He held high office, being the company treasurer between 1634 and 1636, and he was also a deputy in the legislature. However, he sided with Anne Hutchinson in her religious controversy, and so was forced to leave the settlement. He too settled at Portsmouth with Hutchinson, but it did not last long. He became embroiled in a dispute with Hutchinson, so he moved in 1639 to found the settlement of Newport, also on the island of Aquidneck. While he left, relations between the two towns were still friendly-ish, and they unified in 1640, with Coddington elected governor. This makes three. Now we must introduce the final player in Rhode Island history, Warwick and Samuel Gorton. New England is, in many ways, a story of people being continually forced out of places because nobody wanted their religious views. Perhaps Samuel Gorton is the ultimate example of this. Gorton was born in 1593 in my own hometown, Manchester. He was, unlike many of those who travelled to New England, not a Puritan, and this was the root of all his problems. He was inspired by the Puritans and their challenge to traditional Anglican thought, but he didn't reach the same conclusions. He believed that the Holy Spirit was inside every person, giving them an inner divinity, and that this divinity should be followed, rather than human authorities. A sort of spiritism. Given the authoritarian position of the Massachusetts Church, confrontation was inevitable. He would never actually identify with a specific denomination, but this ideology was taken up by later groups, such as the Quakers. This is easy to see by looking at terminology. A common phrase used by the Quakers is to talk about inner light, or the spirit of God within us. Gorton travelled to Massachusetts in 1637, but he did this because he misunderstood what Massachusetts was. He believed that it was a bastion of religious toleration, which it most certainly wasn't. After he arrived in Massachusetts, it didn't take very long for him to run into trouble. His views were controversial, and the magistrates of Massachusetts wanted to avoid controversy, and anything which threatened the unity they were trying to create. He was very quickly banished, and he fled to Plymouth, hoping to find a better life there. This was, you'll recall, what Roger Williams had tried. However, just like Williams, he wasn't keen on Plymouth either. He found Plymouth too intolerant for him, and so he left and moved to Aquidneck Island, hoping to find the peace he wanted at either Portsmouth or Newport. Gorton soon got into trouble with Coddington and was whipped and forced to flee. He found protection at Providence with Williams, but still couldn't settle there. In 1643, he decided he would just found his own town, since he couldn't get on with anybody else. He moved to the western shore of the bay and set up Warwick, where he was joined by those who shared his opinions, because literally nowhere else would have him. So, by 1643, we have four settlements around Narragansett Bay: Providence, Newport, Portsmouth, and Warwick. These four did not get on. This isn't that surprising. I mean, Gorton had been rejected by all three of the other settlements, and if you put that many towns that close together, competition is inevitable. These four towns could have very easily fallen to infighting and been absorbed by one of their bigger neighbours. They were, after all, surrounded by Massachusetts, Plymouth, Connecticut, and the Indians too. They were all lurking, and they recognised the potential threat that this would cause. So they decided the best way to prevent their liberty being taken by one of the larger states was to cement a legal claim to the territory. Williams returned to London for a year, and returned with the 1644 Charter, which he managed to win against the wishes of the Massachusetts Bay Company. This charter was quite similar to the other charters we've seen so far in the story. The incorporation of Providence Plantation was given the land around Narragansett Bay. They could not make laws contrary to the laws of England, but apart from this, they had the right to self-govern as they saw fit and use the land how they wanted. While this wasn't the optimal solution for the towns, who were very proud of their independent nature, they began to come together in order to best protect themselves. The government of the four towns was unified in 1647. In May 1647, representatives from the four towns met in Portsmouth and had something of a constitutional convention. It decided that the colony, Rhode Island, would be governed by an assembly made up of representatives from the four towns. While they knew that this assembly had to exist, it was to be kept weak. They disliked the centralised government of Massachusetts, and there were many unique factors of the Rhode Island Constitution. Any law passed by the Assembly had to be ratified by the towns, and legislation could only be initiated by a proposal from the towns, not by the Assembly itself. There was to be a president who was elected by the Assembly, in addition to the four assistants who were also elected. This would happen once a year. The assembly would be made up of four representatives from each town. It was a federation which had freedom of conscience and the separation of church and state. This all embodied the beliefs of Roger Williams. The dominant political battle for the following decades would be behind the scenes between Williams and Coddington. Coddington opposed the plans, and briefly in the 1650s, managed to secure his own patent for Aquidneck Island, but this only lasted a few years before Williams managed to have it revoked. The situation wasn't properly resolved until the Royal Charter of 1663, issued by Charles II, but this is still a bit down the road. We are now finished with Rhode Island for the time being, and shall instead look at the founding of Connecticut. Connecticut is a rather interesting case, and it marks a turning point in the narrative. One of the defining features of the American story is the push westwards. Connecticut is the point in the narrative where the second group of English settlements, New England, begins this move away from the coast. They had previously stayed close to Massachusetts Bay, but as the Puritan migration continued, the settlers needed more land, and so they began to expand into the Connecticut Valley. The movement began in 1632, when our old friend Edward Winslow of Plymouth conducted a trading mission. Other ones followed, including one by another old friend, John Oldham. As the valley was explored, it became clear just how fertile it was. The other colonies soon began to eye up the territory. The Pilgrims and Dutch both began to construct outposts, Hartford and Windsor. But the ones most interested in the area were the poor settlers of Massachusetts. The person who would lead these efforts on behalf of England was Thomas Hooker. Hooker had moved to Massachusetts in 1633 and was one of the early leaders, but he disliked being overshadowed by John Cotton, whom you'll recall Hutchinson had followed to the colony. Hooker also had concerns over the colony's government. He disliked the fusion of church and state, how much power had been given to the magistrates, and the effects of the religious qualification for citizenship. He also had economic concerns, finding the lands on Massachusetts Bay not of much use. The initial movement was setting up new towns with a slightly broader power base, but not very much different to Massachusetts. In addition to Windsor and Hartford, the new towns in the Connecticut Valley included Wethersfield and Springfield, which would eventually leave this group and is today part of Massachusetts. Although the exact legal status of these settlements was confused early on. I doubt you're surprised. The phrases New England colony and confused legal status seem to be inseparable. They were sort of acting under the jurisdiction of Massachusetts, but they desired their own political autonomy and began to make moves towards securing it. They set up a general court in 1637, where representatives from the towns would meet and they could discuss matters which affected them all, such as methods of dealing with the Indians. This was a preamble. Things really began to get interesting in 1639 with the Fundamental Orders of Connecticut. Connecticut wouldn't receive a royal charter until 1662, which does make sense considering the English Civil War. I'm quite sure for the intervening two decades, Parliament would have more pressing matters than formalising Connecticut. I mean, technically Massachusetts was in rebellion, and nobody cared about that. The Fundamental Orders of Connecticut began with a social compact, and then set up the government for the colony. There was a General Assembly made up of four representatives from each town. This assembly was to meet twice a year. The qualification for citizenship and voting rights was not religious, as it was in the case of Massachusetts, but instead based upon acceptance by the majority of inhabitants in the individual towns. The Puritan character of the early settlers must be noted, so generally the people that were accepted were also of the same mindset. The elected delegates had legislative responsibilities and elected magistrates, which formed an upper house of the legislature and an executive. The exact function of the magistrates was vague, but not as murky as the magistrates of Massachusetts. This is where we'll leave things for this week. There we go. We have the majority of the New England settlements set up. We now have an issue of what to do next. There really isn't that much going on in the New World until we get into the 1660s. We had this issue when we covered Virginia. So, rather than moving all of New England into the 1660s in one or two episodes and then exploring how the region has developed, I think I want to save that for a bit later in the narrative. What I think makes the most sense to do right now is to properly introduce the other players. This is why, next week, we're going to finally turn towards the Dutch. They featured as background reoccurring characters for our first 35 episodes, but now I want to bring them to the front and centre, establish New Netherlands and New Amsterdam. If you've enjoyed today's episode, remember to visit us online. You can find the website at thehistoryofpodcast.com. This is the place to go to sign up for membership. Special thanks to our newest pioneers, listeners William and Pavan. I couldn't do this show without you. You can also send me an email, thehistoryofpodcast@gmail.com, if you have any questions, comments or concerns. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/thehistoryofpodcast, and follow me on Twitter, @historyjamie. I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.